This is Sound Ideas. I'm Charlie Schlenker. A lot of people think affordable housing will attract riffraff. Not so much.
They really need to look at the statistics. Affordable housing can be up to 80% of an area median income, and that's definitely working class.
Larry Pusateri of the Lightengale Group says $50,000 of household income could be, well, you. WGLT gives you a five-part series on affordable housing, housing scarcity, helping felons get housing, housing vouchers, rehousing, and segregation. It's a full newsroom effort. Plus, John Norton brings us a new live recorded album from Hot Sauce Universe. All that and a GLT news update on the way. This is Sound Ideas on GLT.
Support for the Sound Ideas podcast comes from GLT listeners. Join the community of news consumers who listen to Sound Ideas and are also willing to support it financially. Learn more about listener-supported radio and GLT at WGLT.org.
This is Sound Ideas. I'm Charlie Schlenker. Affordable housing advocates say it's time to stop saying "not in my backyard" to such housing projects. Stakeholders across Illinois say affordable housing might actually be your yard. WGLT's Mary Cullen reports.
Sometimes the scariest part of affordable housing is the name. Larry Pusateri is vice president of the Lightengale Group, a Chicago-based affordable housing consulting group that does work across the country. Pusateri says the largest barrier to any affordable housing project is gaining public support, yet it should not be.
They really need to look at the statistics. Affordable housing can be up to 80% of an area median income, and that's definitely working class.
And those who qualify for affordable housing come from a variety of job sectors. Michael Banghart is the executive director at Renaissance Social Services. He says affordable housing isn't just for the poor and homeless. It's for teachers, first responders, maybe even your family member or you.
It's pretty much housing that is, for the average everyday person. They need to live somewhere. Not everyone's a CEO.
And Banghart says even if this might not be you now, it could be you later. There are societal reasons the snapshot of people eligible or living in affordable housing is so diverse. Mary Ellen Tomasi is the vice president of development with Community Partners for Affordable Housing based in Lake County. She says the middle class is being priced out of the housing market.
We're helping home buyers in a community right now buy homes who are making $50,000 and $60,000 a year, but that's affordable housing for them because they can't buy anything at $50,000 a year.
Tomasi says housing is a ladder, moving up from no home to renting to owning a home. When one person moves up the ladder from renting to owning, a space opens for the next person. But Tomasi says the system can become stuck if the economy does not allow people to advance.
For someone who's homeless, it may take them a while to get a job, get back on their feet so they can rent a place. So it's a continuum of people moving up a ladder, and when a rung gets broken, then there's a swelling at the bottom.
That swelling means more homelessness. And Larry Pusateri says homelessness is a reason the public should support affordable housing developments.
If you don't serve people who are on the edge, right, who are just barely making it, living in substandard housing, then that will become a societal problem.
This is how he makes the case when pitching projects to cities and towns.
I'd like to tell them, you're going to pay for this housing one way or another. You're going to pay for it at the hospital, or you're going to pay for it with your police, or you're going to pay for it now and be proactive, but you're going to pay for this.
And if there is local support, Pusateri says the federal government throws in needed funding.
We just need you to do the action. Well, that's a pretty good deal.
Pusateri says governments often won't okay a project without neighborhood support. He says it's in a community's best interest to get a hold on housing issues fast and to build coalitions with many stakeholders. I'm Mary Cullen.
Larry Positeri presented on affordable housing at the Housing Action Illinois Conference in Bloomington, the source of our series today. A pilot program in the Chicago area aims to break the cycle of homelessness through better health. The pilot program stresses the importance of collaboration and cost sharing. WGLT's Eric Stock reports McLean County is working on a similar model.
The program is called Better Health Through Housing. Organizers in Cook County say they've taken nearly 50 people off the streets and into shelter in the first 6 months. Nonprofits secured promises from hospitals and health insurers to pay for housing for the homeless that the hospitals identify as frequent users of the healthcare system. Carlos De Jesus Rivera is director of housing for the Center for Housing and Health, the lead agency for the program.
If you take housing into account, the health conditions of the participants will significantly improve, and therefore it's a savings on health dollars when that happens. So housing is tantamount to health care.
De Jesus Rivera says many without a roof over their head get caught in a vicious health cycle.
Just being exposed to the elements in Chicago, it makes any condition you have worse. And so if you're housed, then you can have insulin in your refrigerator. You can be in a sheltered environment.
Others say the program also addresses racial inequality. Julie Nelson of the Corporation for Supportive Housing says 80% of the homeless population in Chicago is African American.
People of color are targeted for arrests. Convictions look different. That then impacts ability to get work. That impacts evictions. And so that drives people towards homelessness.
The program creates a flexible housing pool. Caseworkers help homeless clients with insurance and housing and try to make sure they get to the doctor. Patricia Strokes is with Housing Forward, an agency contracted to provide caseworkers. She says the program goes beyond the sustainable housing the federal government offers because healthcare staff see firsthand who needs housing assistance.
They know that a person is physically vulnerable because the hospital, the medical systems are working with them, but they don't necessarily have to be homeless in the same way.
The U.S. Department of Housing and Urban Development offers supportive housing funding only for those it defines as chronically homeless and disabled. The original model for the Cook County service is in Los Angeles. That effort reports sharp drops in emergency room visits, days in the hospital, and fewer mental health hospitalizations over the first 7 years of the program. Julie Nelson with the Corporation for Supportive Housing says the flexible housing pool is adaptable anywhere you have health care and community partners willing to work together.
So a lot of it can be driven by data within the own community. So understanding who your frequent utilizers are, creating partnerships, building those relationships across these partners between the private sector, between hospitals, between government, between your homeless service providers, and really going from there to identify a common goal.
CSH has also been working with the McLean County in its efforts to stem homelessness by identifying those who most frequently need health care or homeless services or go to jail. That's through the county's new FUSE program. It stands for Frequent User Systems Engagement. McLean County Mental Health Program Supervisor Tricia Malott says FUSE's goal is to provide mental health and substance abuse services and help the homeless find stable housing and employment. Malott says the program is located only to frequent users in the first 2 months. The startup plan is for service to 10 clients per year. She says once the program has reportable results, the county will ask hospitals and health insurers to help defray costs.
That's our goal. So we continue to have dialogue with both hospitals to try to be able to incorporate that so that we truly can get to the folks who are intersecting all high need, high cost systems.
The county has set aside about $670,000 for FUSE annually through a sales tax increase in Bloomington and Normal approved a few years ago. I'm Eric Stock.
Chicago Mayor Lori Lightfoot has pledged an additional $5 million for that city's flexible housing pool. Several foundations offer housing for the homeless in Peoria through a variety of funding sources, including local lenders and tax credits for low-income housing and for historic properties. Many factors contribute to homelessness: poverty, poor health, unemployment, addiction, domestic violence, and many other things that may interact with each other. In some cases, it's easy to pinpoint the cause and prevent it from happening. WGLT News correspondent Brianna Groh has the story of how the city of Peoria created a rehousing program last year to help address the problem.
Where can tenants turn when landlords' negligence or lack of resources threatens to put them out on the streets? Speakers at a Housing Action Illinois conference in Bloomington say a partnership between the city of Peoria and the Salvation Army is one example of how communities can work to rehouse residents. Last year, the city deemed a 96-unit apartment building unfit for human habitation. The Salvation Army jumped in to help the city rehouse the 45 displaced residents. The city fined the landlord $50,000 and used the funds as seed money to launch an ongoing rehousing program. Joe Doolin, Assistant Community Development Director for the City of Peoria, says the code enforcement process can sometimes create homelessness at no fault of the tenant.
Some of the most common ones are no heat, so the furnace broke. Maybe there's a gas problem, the gas gets shut off. Water heaters, no hot water, things like that. Those are things that require us to post the property on occupancy prohibited because it's no longer safe for someone to be in.
Thomas Phillip, Salvation Army Tri-County Social Services Director, says while one of the organization's main operations is its homeless shelters.
I think this program allows us to skip that step. We get them housed before they become homeless.
After releasing a request for proposals, the city selected the Salvation Army to administer the program. The city refers tenants to the Salvation Army, which then deploys its resources to rehouse them as quickly as possible, typically a few days. Since its inception, the program has overseen 5 successful rehousing cases at an average cost of $2,500 per case. Doolin says the city uses the criminal housing management fines collected from landlords to sustain the program.
The landlord is the one who ultimately caused the situation and caused us have to get these services going for the tenant. And we want to make sure they're responsible for repaying it so other taxpayers and other residents aren't responsible for that.
Phillips says without tight restrictions on how the money can be used, the program helps cover everything from application fees to moving expenses that may otherwise prevent rehousing. Bloomington Housing Authority Executive Director Jeremy Hayes says the issue isn't unique to Peoria.
We've seen this scenario where an individual is renting and the property owner sells the building, or the property owner loses that property in foreclosure. We've seen that before as well.
Hayes says officials in the city of Bloomington already approach the issue of code enforcement carefully.
I do know that they are very much aware of the impact of aggressive enforcement and just looking for compliance. That always seems to be the goal.
Doolin says for communities looking to replicate Peoria's program, a working relationship between municipalities and nonprofits is a must.
This wouldn't have been possible if we just relisted an RFP and didn't have nonprofits who trusted the city to deliver on our end or create more problems. And likewise, if the city didn't have a very trusting and positive relationship with the Salvation Army when they bid on a project like this, we'd be nervous. It takes everyone working together, regardless of what your mission is, to really improve community, improve life for your residents.
Bloomington's Home Sweet Home Ministries also engages referrals from PATH Homeless Services in a rapid rehousing program. I'm Brianna Groh.
You can find more information about Housing Action Illinois and the workshops from this year's conference online at housingactionil.org. Thanks to Google and online court records, it's easier than ever to find someone's criminal record. And for those trying to rebuild their life after incarceration, that record can make it hard or even impossible to find housing. WGLT's Ryan Denham reports on advocates who are trying to fix that.
Maria Moon spent 13 years in prison, but forget I said that, because her mantra is, I am not my record. What Moon really is a community organizer, a filmmaker, and an advocate for those who've been behind bars and want to find housing when they get out. She says too often they can't.
You know, we always, society, we find somebody to outcast. You know, we find somebody has to be the scapegoat, the black sheep, huh?
Moon works for the Chicago Area Fair Housing Alliance. That group was part of a coalition that this year won passage of the new Just Housing Ordinance in Cook County. For From now on, housing providers will not be able to consider certain aspects of criminal records, such as arrests, juvenile records, or sealed and expunged records. And for would-be tenants with a conviction on their record, Moon says housing providers will need to conduct an individualized assessment, looking at mitigating factors. Moon says that is huge.
They may want to present the fact that they were 17 years old and now they're 45, or the fact that that happened 30 years ago. Or I have all these certificates, or I have these rehabilitation classes that I went to, or, you know, just things of that sort. Just seeing the, just not looking at the person and saying you have a record and just judging them based on that.
The stakes are high, as is the number of people impacted. Kate Walls of the Shriver Center on Poverty Law says around 640,000 people are released from prison every year. Not being able to find a place to live increases the odds they'll end up back in prison. Walls says America's discriminatory housing practices lag the progress made for job seekers with a criminal record who have more protections. Even big companies have been vocal about hiring people with records. Just last week, J.P. Morgan Chase, one of the biggest banks in the world, announced a second chance hiring program for those convicted of minor crimes, like disorderly conduct, personal drug possession, or driving under the influence.
And so we haven't seen that type of shift from the top, from major landlords and property management companies, but we need to, because just as someone needs a job, they need a home, and they need the ability to reconnect with their loved ones and community.
Cook County's ordinance is one way to address this, and a new state law complements that ordinance. It goes into effect January 1st and will make it a Human Rights Act violation to deny someone housing on the basis of an arrest without a conviction, or due to a court record that's been expunged, sealed, or impounded from public view. Kate Walls of the Shriver Center says it's unlikely that justice-involved people and their supporters will have much luck in Congress addressing the issue at a federal level.
And so we're taking those opportunities then to really have one-on-one conversations at the state and local level about our values.
Walls says that the new local and state laws are the result of justice-involved people like Maria Moon leading the charge, not just being background players or props at a press conference.
Because they're realizing this is my neighbor, this is somebody I went to high school with, or this is somebody's son that I know, and they actually do have a lot of power at the local and state level to make a big difference.
Others are trying to attack the problem from other directions. This year, the Illinois Housing Development Authority is launching a program that'll give rental assistance to those who are just leaving prison. It's small for now, about 100 clients, mostly elderly or disabled people or those deemed ready to work. But it not only gives them money for rent, but also allows them to sign a lease before they even leave prison. One less barrier to restarting life and getting back on track. I'm Ryan Denham.
This is Sound Ideas. I'm Charlie Schlenker. We continue our series on housing and segregation in central Illinois. Under the state's current tax model and budget practices, Illinois will not be fiscally prepared to properly fund education, social services, pensions, and more for decades to come. That's according to Drizelle Feliu, the research director for the Center for Tax and Budget Accountability. Speaking at the Housing Action Illinois Conference in Bloomington last week, Feliu talks about how a progressive income tax could change that.
Income inequality is rising nationally, which should come as no surprise. The top 10% experienced 34.1% growth in income from 1947 to 1979. That exploded from 1979 to 2015 to 108.4%. Meanwhile, the bottom 90 went from 65.9% growth to an actual 8.4% decline over the same period. In Illinois specifically, the top 1% of income earners saw almost threefold growth in their incomes, while the bottom 99% saw only a meager increase of 9% over the same time frame. When you start to look at what the bottom 90% of Illinois looks like, you'll see that it's even worse. It was a decline in real income of about $1,400 on average over that time. In comparison to the top 10% of Illinois residents, the same national trends emerge, with the majority of income growth going to the top 10% on average. When you start to focus on wealth, similar patterns appear. 77.1% of national wealth was held by the top 10% of income earners, according to the Survey of Consumer Finances. This highlights the problem with the state of Illinois' tax policy, when the portion of income earners who have experienced the greatest growth in incomes contributed the smallest percentage of income as a group. The top 1% of earners in the state of Illinois only pay 7.4% of their income in state and local taxes combined. The lowest income earners, those below $12,400 annually, contribute a significantly larger share of their incomes. This income disparity becomes even larger after state and local taxes are collected, further widening the income gap between all groups of earners and the top 10%. So after individuals have actually paid their taxes on the lower end, they're now 149 times less than the top 1%. This presents significant challenges for those on the lower end of the income distribution. While median income has grown slightly at 6.4%, the cost of living, as represented by the change in the Consumer Price Index, has actually outpaced it at 29.7% from 2004 to 2017. So given all this, the proposed fair tax actually provides an opportunity to address this inequality by having the highest income earners contribute their fair share. The graduated rate structure includes a marginal tax by income bracket, except for the top bracket, where all income is taxed at that 7.99% rate. This proposed fair tax allows the state to be more equitable. It cuts taxes for 97% of taxpayers, so that only the top 3% see an actual increase in their bills, and it raises $3.6 billion annually in new revenue starting in 2021. Additionally, that would also adjust for inflation over the long run. That top tax rate of 7.99% is actually in line with many neighboring states here in the Midwest, which is key to addressing a common concern, which is sort of the flight of individuals from the state of Illinois. By instituting the fair tax, the state can actually start to shift the burden away from lower income earners and towards the top 1%, making their contributions in state and local taxes more in line with the rest of the residents in the state. The red line that you see is what's currently being contributed by each income category in their share of state and local taxes. The gray line is actually a representation of what it would be under the proposed fair tax, bringing the top 1% up from 7.4% of their income to 10.8%. And so while the fair tax is absolutely necessary, it's not a magic bullet. It's not going to solve all the problems. Modernizing the state's sales tax policy is just as necessary. Currently, the state taxes goods sold and only a handful of services provided, most of them municipal utility services. This has not been reflective of the changes experienced by the modern economy, where 73% of the state's GDP is actually captured through services. In order to be an effective tax policy, sales taxes must be economically responsive, and they have not been for years. So one of the key questions is, won't tax increases kill the economy? A lot of research literature actually suggests the opposite. A 2012 study commissioned by the U.S. Small Business Administration found that there's actually no evidence of any economic impact of state tax portfolios on entrepreneurial activity, suggesting that they're not actually deterring individuals from attempting to start new businesses. The Truman Institute found that the benefits of tax breaks are always smaller than the economic loss due to spending cuts, resulting in a net economic loss each time. And the Congressional Budget Office found that there's no correlation at all between tax policy and job creation, that private sector demand is actually what matters. A really interesting case study actually exists between Kansas and Minnesota. Kansas cut its top rate from 6% to 4.5% in 2012. So the economic benefits should have trickled down. They didn't. The state has actually seen reduced revenue from income taxes and is now relying on other revenue sources to make up the difference as a larger share of their budgets. Meanwhile, in Minnesota, economic conditions were challenging to begin with, a $6.2 billion deficit and high unemployment. 4 years after Mark Dayton raised the top income tax rate from 7.85% to 9.85%, the state had a $1.2 billion surplus and saw a reduction in unemployment with 172,000 new jobs. Looking more broadly, We looked at the 9 states with the highest top tax rates and the 9 states with no income tax rates at all. And the states with the 9 states with the highest top tax rates actually outperformed the 9 states without them from 2007 to 2017, a period that also included the Great Recession. They generated more in GDP, more in personal income, and more in personal consumption. Even nationally, we don't have evidence that tax increases restrict economic growth. The tax increases of the 90s under Bush Sr. and Clinton didn't produce that result, and specifically, the tax cuts under Bush II didn't spur economic growth. And so part of what I had suggested earlier about whether or not individuals will leave the state en masse when taxes rise is also probably not realistic. Illinois has actually had more individuals leave the state than enter it every year but one, except since 1925. The year that that out-migration rate declined was actually in 2011 during the temporary tax increase. Since then, a greater percentage of individuals have moved into Illinois from Indiana and Wisconsin than have actually moved out. Through modernizing tax policy and making it more equitable, the state of Illinois should be able to address its pension responsibilities, further fund and improve the education system, and begin to look to expand the key services the state's residents need. Thank you.
That's Drizelle Feliu, Research Director at the Center for Tax and Budget Accountability, speaking at last week's Housing Action Illinois Conference in Bloomington. This speech has been edited for clarity. Earlier this year, reporters from Governing Magazine laid down a mammoth investigative report showing that some mid-sized cities in Illinois are among the most segregated in the nation. The causes are many, the cures are difficult. Change would take generations, even if communities pull together to address the issue. As part of this WGLT Newsroom series on housing issues, most experts agree change must be incremental. Minorities make up a disproportionate share of the lower-income population in most cities. Cheryl Boswell of Peoria is a past board member of Housing Action Illinois. Boswell says to get at segregation, cities such as Peoria and Bloomington Normal should require new multi-unit developments to have an affordable housing component.
How do we move the needle forward with policy that would help when policies come in place and they do housing, that there are some set-asides or some requirements in the development, that so many of those housing or units will have to be for low income?
Boswell grew up being bused from the south side of Peoria to school in an effort to desegregate schools. A generation later, Peoria schools are still very black or very white, depending on where they are. She said city infrastructure decisions affect that.
Oh, it matters 100%. One of the worst things that I believe that happened in the city of Peoria was the urban renewal that came through here in the late 60s, early 70s. It broke cultures, it tore up neighborhoods, it totally changed communities that were on the south side of Peoria.
She says revitalization to develop blighted areas must build communities and not just talk about how old the housing stock is. To do that, Boswell says Peoria has to invest in infrastructure, streets, sewers, and make it easier to develop housing, which in turn creates property tax base.
When you look at the migration of the population out of the city, those are revenue dollars that the city lost. Somehow we have to get revenue back into the city, and I think housing is a way to do that.
She thinks the city should find ways, in addition to tax credits, to make development easier. There's an even more macro issue that encourages segregation in Peoria, Bloomington Normal, Springfield, and any other traditionally structured city. It's zoning. Anne Hotelling directs Hope Fair Housing, which serves 30 counties in northern and north central Illinois. She says the first time we had zoning was in the 1920s, and the origin is racist.
That's the first time we started to see zoning, and it started to segregate people. It was designed to have these single family areas that would be exclusionary and exclude people of color from the communities.
Hotelling says cities can counter this now by being more inclusive in rental housing requirements to promote mixed income areas. But she says there is an economic case for broader use of the tool as well. For instance, when a municipality considers moribund commercially zoned strip malls for redevelopment, Hotelling says rezoning for mixed use helps in a number of ways.
If you reimagine that as retail and commercial on the bottom, restaurants and the dry cleaner and the cell phone repair store and housing above, then you have the housing, but you also have a built-in market for the stores below. And you're retaining that income in the neighborhood, and you're also helping to integrate it at the same time.
In fact, that's the way a lot of cities and towns looked in the 1800s and early 1900s, and Hotelling says they could again. As cities approach redevelopment, they have to decide where to put their markers. Everywhere at once or in specific areas. This is a political issue for any representative council, how to share out scarce assets. But City of Urbana grants manager Sheila Dodd says there's a case for using redevelopment incentives and funds in a concentrated area until you get results. One of her previous jobs was director of Habitat for Humanity in Champaign-Urbana. Dodd says they used money from the housing foreclosure lawsuit settlement and an Illinois Housing Development Authority grant to tear down 10 homes in a blighted 8-block square area in Urbana and build new ones. And results happen fast.
And in like a 4-year time period, we saw assessments at a minimum go up $2,000 and some even more than that. And in that older housing stock neighborhood, that's huge, you know, to see that investment go back in, families start to move back in. It's a nice mix of seniors and younger families, and they kind of help each other out.
Dodd says not only did the neighborhood stabilize, diversity increased. And with people moving in, she says it's now worth additional city resources to improve infrastructure.
They have taken a look at that neighborhood and are going to be putting in sidewalk ramps and investing in the new street overlays and sidewalk repairs that need to be done.
And Dodd points out better streets and sidewalks will, over time, improve housing values as well. Another reason to concentrate a city's redevelopment effort, Dodd says, is pure public perception as available federal and city dollars shrink.
Really, for people to feel like the city of Urbana cares and they really are investing in their community, we need to have that more concentrated area of focus as much as we can.
By focusing on a single tight geographic redevelopment area, Dodd says, it's easier for other agencies and arms of the city to coordinate efforts in that same territory, such as rehabs, social service funding, and leveraging grants. On a smaller scale, affordable housing tends to be in clusters, and those clusters can perpetuate segregation. Some people qualify for housing choice vouchers to help with rent. Those are supposed to be portable anywhere in a city. Landlords are not supposed to turn down people with vouchers because they are low income. Studies show property owners often discriminate anyway. Naperville and some other entities such as Champaign and Cook County have fair housing ordinances on top of federal rules. Ann Hotelling of Hope Fair Housing says a number of people inside and outside Naperville city government came together to take on this issue.
We at Hope Fair Housing Center were receiving complaints from people, veterans with disabilities, who were turned down from renting because they had a housing choice voucher, and were getting a response from the city that they weren't sure that their source of income ordinance included housing choice vouchers. And so there was sort of a groundswell of people not being able to access housing in Naperville.
Now, in many communities, Hotelling and other housing experts say community organizing is something of a lost art. She says there is plenty of anger and motivation, but less of the careful education, coalition building, and stakeholder involvement that affect real change. It's not easy or quick work. Hotelling says in Naperville, the group pushing voucher anti-discrimination provisions did that work and even found landlords in the upscale community to lobby for the measure because they came to see vouchers as desirable.
If somebody loses their job, the housing authority picks up the rest until they get another job and they're able to contribute to the housing. And so it's a guaranteed stream of rent for the landlord.
A second reason property owners should like housing choice vouchers, Hotelling says, is that the tenants tend to be more predictable than the general public.
You know, people wait for years and years. There's not enough assistance to go around for these housing choice vouchers. People wait, and then they finally get them, and they treat it like a winning lottery ticket. They are very good tenants who follow the rules and maintain the property because they want to make sure that they can have the housing assistance as long as they need it.
She says any community needs someone to herd the cats and keep the conversations going until policy measures emerge. Bloomington, Normal, and Peoria do not have such voucher choice anti-discrimination measures in place. But Hotelling says segregation and discrimination happens at all economic levels, too. And while housing voucher choice and anti-discrimination measures might move the needle on segregation, she says residents also have to be aware of their own tendencies to self-segregate. When people go to find a house or condo or an apartment, they look partly based on the job, the commute, and the quality of the area. But Hotelling says people tend to seek out advice from people they know to help shape the search.
Your social networks, because we're segregated, our social networks are segregated. And so when you tap your social network for where you're going to live, you're already tapping into segregation and the cycle continues.
Hotelling says changing policy at the top is important, but as individuals, we can also choose to integrate our own social networks. She says if cooking, biking, knitting, or a book group is your thing, you can work to integrate those groups so that when housing decisions come up, your social network will be as diverse as the city in which you want to live. All of these stories in this WGLT Newsroom series on housing came through the Housing Action Illinois Conference last week held in Bloomington Normal. I'm Charlie Schlenker.
Support for WGLT comes from the Illinois Prairie Community Foundation, celebrating local philanthropy on November 14th with a workshop for nonprofits and luncheon honoring Paul and Sandra Harmon, 2019 Philanthropists of the Year. More information at ilprairiecf.org. This is 89.1 WGLT and WGLT.org.
This is Sound Ideas. I'm Charlie Schlenker. Coming up, John Norton brings us a look at a live recorded new album by Hot Sauce Universe. Under federal law, every child is entitled to an education, even children with special needs. And if they can't be taught in regular school, districts have to pay extra to have the students taught in private facilities. Now, one district has disenrolled 10 students to avoid paying those costs, and it has led to a legal battle. IPR's Dusty Rhodes explains.
With most lawsuits, you can read the pleadings and decide who's the bad guy. But in this case, I can't find a bad guy. The plaintiff represents 10 children with profound disabilities. The defendant is one of the poorest school districts in the state. That's the West Harvey Dixmoor Elementary District. It's 20 miles south of Chicago in a suburb Wikipedia bluntly describes as suffering from high levels of unemployment, poverty, and crime. The students in this lawsuit reside within one of the few businesses in Harvey, Children's Habilitation Center. I asked CEO Pamela Markle to explain the name.
Habilitation is where you try to prevent further contractures. You're never going to get back to a so-called normal state. It is working with them to help prevent more deterioration.
All 65 residents are on feeding tubes. Most use wheelchairs, and a majority depend on ventilators. But despite the medical machinery that surrounds and sustains them, there's no forgetting that they're children.
What's that?
It's headphones.
I want to hear it.
And like most kids, they spend their days in school. A few, like the 4-year-old girl who asked about my headphones, are transported daily to outside schools. But most residents at Children's Habilitation Center, or CHC, have the kind of complex physical needs that require constant access to medical staff. So they attend class inside the facility, where education is tailored to their developmental levels. With older kids, that might involve assistive technology.
Juan, have you trick-or-treated?
Yes. But with younger children, it can be as simple as sensory exposure, like mixing food coloring with shaving cream, digging the seeds out of a pumpkin, or putting their hands into a bin of uncooked rice.
You know, for us it feels cool, but for them it feels a little different.
Jane Lurquin, who has a doctorate in special education, directs the classes at CHC.
I have one that he never moved. Now when you say his name, he lifts his head up and looks for you. There's another one that she's now starting to hold my finger a little, but she also learned how to turn her monitor on and beep when I leave. We've had a couple that actually moved out because they have progressed enough to move back to the family.
Under Illinois state law, each CHC resident's home school district covers part of their tuition. And last year, per usual, West Harvey Dixmoor was one of 9 districts paying tuition for CHC residents. But this year, Harvey's new superintendent, Janetta Miller, kicked most CHC students off its rolls. William Gleason is the attorney for the school district.
Mrs. Miller, within her fiduciary responsibilities for the Board of Education, observed the amount of money that was being spent to CHC, and she did raise concerns of there's several $100,000 going out. Is this money that we should be spending?
You can't blame her for trying to save money. Despite an increase in state dollars brought about by the new funding formula, the district continues to be one of the very poorest in the state, with just 62% of the funds it needs to meet adequacy. CHC has filed a lawsuit against Harvey Schools, as well as the State Board of Education, asking it to decide who pays tuition for these children. The case hinges on where the parents live and getting them to enroll their children in those districts to make them pay for the tuition. But Markle, the CEO, says that's easier said than done.
Most of our clientele, the parents are in poverty. They have issues of their own. We only have about 10 children that have parents involved. We really are their family.
The State Board of Education is expected to issue a decision this week. Meanwhile, CHC is continuing to educate all school-age residents. I'm Dusty Rhodes.
Support for WGLT comes from The Music Shop, helping student musicians of all skill levels sound their best by partnering with school band and orchestra programs throughout Central Illinois. Instrument rentals, sales, maintenance, and repair. Details at themusicshop.com. This is 89.1 WGLT and WGLT.org.
This is Sound Ideas. I'm Charlie Schlenker. Intentionally recording a studio album with a live audience can be perilous. What if the audience doesn't respond? What if the performers aren't in sync musically that night? For Janae and Jay Thomason of Hot Sauce Universe, that's the point. They say years ago they made a pact to record all their albums live with no overdubs. When the husband-wife team won a free recording session at Rock Solid Studio in Dunlap, they invited fans to sit in on the making of their latest album, According to Lore, ahead of the second annual bonus bash, a Friday night at Night Shop, presented by Hot Sauce Universe. Janae tells WGLT's John Norton the idea for the live audience sparked after re-recording their recent song, Real Fang, for a video shoot.
And the energy just wasn't the same. Me and him in a room in the dark. Like, we tried to vibe it up as much as possible, but it's just not the same without the audience there for us to give to and then thusly receive back and sort of cultivate and cycle that energy around.
So did it do what you wanted it to do? I mean, as far as the vibe of the room?
Oh, my gosh.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah. And what's crazy is we actually almost canceled at the last minute because it was a night of crazy storms that were happening. So we all had emergency signals coming to our phones saying that there's flash flood warnings, the tornado sirens went off, so on and so forth. And so
there was thunder and lightning.
So there was electricity in the air, and they made it even better.
Honestly,
we had people
did.
Traveling from like Champaign and Bloomington, wow. And it was up in Dunlap.
So yeah.
Well, you mentioned Real Thing. You've already recorded that. You put it on this album.
Mm-hmm.
Why?
Because we love it.
Yeah, this is true for both of the tunes that we re-recorded, Real Thing and Back Off Dude. Mm-hmm. We feel like both of the tunes deserve really great representation for what the song is.
Well, you got what I want, and what you need is me loving you so heavenly. But now we're living undeniably in love. When the times are tough, we got gold means that we don't have to spend a lot. Don't need 3 cars and jet skis. Don't need big screens or streaming fees. Cause even on the streets, it'd be you and me. Living life, we're laughing good. We don't need anything. What we've cultivated, this trust that it's us. No matter what strikes, what hits, we got this. And it'll be damn good, you see. Typical, putting on a show like life is grand, you know. We got the real thing, we got the real thing. Da 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 ba da ba doom da 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 ba da ba da.
It's an obvious love song between the two of you?
It's more than that as well.
Right. I mean, it's about life, you know what I mean? Like,
yeah.
And making life the and most of where you're at, too, you know what
yes.
I mean? Like,
one of the lines is, you got to realize that what you energize, you materialize.
Goodness that is here, don't focus on the fear. You got to realize what you energize, you materialize. Yeah, that's the real thing.
This whole record was pretty intentional. We've never written like this before, but we...
What do you mean? Haven't written like what?
Well, frankly, we jam, man. So, like, Real Things started out sort of as, like, a spoken word sort of thing. I didn't have any melody to it. It was just rhythm and lyrics. And we were at one of our Sunday gigs at Tailgaters down in Leroy, and he played something, and I decided to sing what I had written for that over the top of it, and then we just jammed on it, and then eventually I wrote a second verse, and this is, like, over the course of a year or something. It's ridiculous. So eventually I wrote a second verse, and then the hook, the ba-da-da-da-ba-da-ba-doo, that happened in the car on the way to the Redneck Windchime Festival in 2017.
I legit got the guitar out from the back seat, and, like, we played it. At the show that we were driving to.
Yeah, we played it. We played it like that for the first time, and then it's been like that ever since. Yeah, that's the real thing. Yeah, that's the real thing. Da da ba da ba doom da 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 ba da ba da da ba da ba doom da.
So I talked with Isaac Elker of Good Morning Bedlam. Just a few weeks ago, because they were in town playing Night Shop, and his wife is in the band, all right? Mm-hmm. And there's two other people in the band. He said, it's really cool to write a song with your wife, because, and lyrically, because I can write something, say something, and then she can respond to what I have written, and it's a really neat dynamic.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
You two write songs together, but you're the vocalist and you're the guitarist, and I know you're playing rhythm as well, too. Mm-hmm. Are you guys improvising that way off of each other?
Oh, my gosh, constantly. Yes. And Darkest Days on the album, according to Lore, is actually, like, a great example of that.
It's purely raw. We wrote it in a night. I jotted things down as they came to me. We continued to play it for, I don't know, an hour or something, a half hour or something like that. Frankly, we both cried when we wrote it, and so there were, like, specific chunks that I knew I wanted to get in there, and then we specifically did not...
We didn't touch it.
We didn't touch it after that until we got to the recording.
It's not me on my darkest days. It's a flip side. I'm turning away any love.
I knew what I was going for, and he's just really good at coming right along with me.
Are you talking about the night of the recording itself?
Yeah, performance itself.
So you're improvising during the live performance.
Yeah, so he
during the live recording, I mean.
Oh, yeah.
Oh, yeah.
That would scare the bejesus out of a lot of musicians, right?
Oh, man.
Well, the vulnerability of that comes through on the recording, and that's one of the things that I think people that like to hear us do our thing are attracted to.
Well, and that's so much of what we want to put out. We want to put out that authenticity. And I didn't want to rehearse that song into the ground because it would lose that raw factor. It would lose that authenticity, that honesty of, I just have to get this out and I barely even know what I'm doing with it. One of the lines is, I keep thinking about it.
Na na, ooh, I keep thinking about everything I ever said that was not quite right. I keep thinking about it.
Yeah, I just keep thinking about it. I keep thinking about it. And you kind of keep going over all everything you've ever done that was wrong or not quite right, or you embarrassed yourself or whatever. And, you know, I get into this place of, I'm a horrible person and I don't deserve. And yet here's him who loves me to the depth of my being with every depth of his being. It's unbelievable, but that's what the song is. And without that raw truth, it wouldn't be right.
I wanna be what you need. I wanna see what you mean, but I don't feel anything but bad right now. I wanna be what you need. I wanna see what you mean, but I don't feel anything but bad right now. I keep thinking about it.
Darkest Days is the song from According to Lore, the new release from Janae Thomason, otherwise known as Hot Sauce Universe. I want to get technical. I was lucky enough that you guys let me have an advanced listen to the album, and you had an acoustic and electric going at the same time, and I thought, you know, you had another play. No, there's just the two of you.
Yeah.
This whole thing. How do you do that?
That's one of the things that we think is crucial about this project that we have. It's all live looping. So I have a loop pedal on stage, and the loop pedal has one knob on it. I hit a button, and it instantly starts recording whatever I'm playing. As soon as I hit that button, it starts playing back what I just recorded. And then that knob on there is a volume. So when we're playing live and all over on the recording, I will loop something, and then I'll adjust that playback. And then I also have an octave pedal. So I'll step on the octave pedal to simulate a bass sound, and I might loop that. And then I have some distortion and some effects on my acoustic guitar that I can then step on and basically jam with myself when the loop is playing back. And the album was done live. If you listen to Ain't Got the Right.
Ooh, you ain't got the right, you ain't got the right.
So the guitar solo, there's a bass riff that happens that I loop. After the second chorus, I loop a bass riff, and then that playback continues to playback, and Janae jams with the bass. And then I step on my distortion effect for my lead guitar sound, which is where it starts to sound like an electric, even though it's still the same acoustic guitar. And then I improvise my solo over that. And then after that, I go back to the acoustic sound and I play chords along with the bass loop that's playing. And I use my big toe to fade out the bass line on the volume pedal.
Janae and Jay Thomason of Hot Sauce Universe speaking with WGLT's John Norton. The duo shows off the new album Friday night at Night Shop in Bloomington during their second annual post-Halloween bonus bash. Also appearing, Alex Jordine, No Robot, and Wildermore. Discover local music and hear from artists playing in Central Illinois on the GLT Music Podcast. Find it on NPR One or your favorite podcast app. Thanks for choosing Sound Ideas on WGLT Normal, made possible with listener contributions at WGLT.org. Our website is also where you can find Sound Ideas interviews and stories, which today came from Ryan Denham, Brianna Groh, Mary Cullen, Eric Stock, and John Norton. I'm Charlie Schlenker. This is 89.1 WGLT and WGLT.org, Bloomington Normal's public media.